Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. Another shadow.
Another shadow. Unlike us, who are merely shadows of our former selves.
Well, you do look like you've got eyeshadow on. I mean, for all the people who can't see you, which is everybody... Let's just tell them what I'm looking
at. What you're looking at is a rather angry purple eye because I poked myself with my sunglasses. Not deliberately. I didn't think, oh, I'll poke. I know what I'll do. I'll poke myself with my sunglasses. I was driving and I put my shades on.
Did you have Boys of Summer playing? Wayfarers on and... Or trying to get your Wayfarers on.
Yeah, I was trying to reenact the Boys of Summer and just got it all horribly wrong. And I saw a Deadhead sticker on a Cadillac, and I swerved off the road and crashed. The whole thing was just a disaster.
Anyway, we do have another shadow.
We've got Bruce Welsh, who, unlike Hank, is an OBE. Because Hank couldn't accept his because of his Jehovah's Witness beliefs.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't want to question those, but I didn't know that you couldn't.
No. Well, I only know this from Bruce saying it in an interview.
Oh, right. I mean, let's just go back and just talk about how huge the shadows were and a huge influence. I mean, I have got my little Bill Frindle moment here. Which is between 1960 and 1963, they had 13 consecutive top 10 hits. They had 69 UK chart singles, 33 with the Shadows and 34 as Cliff Richard's backing band.
Wow.
You know, and everybody, all the people who come before us, you know, like, you know, David and Pete and everybody, you know, they all admire
to a man, they all say Hank. And it's...
Well, they don't all say Hank. I'll tell you why I know that, because the Shadows documentary, which I know you've seen, but maybe a long time ago,
yes.
we won't watch it. Pete says it was Bruce. For him, it was Bruce.
Oh.
And he says...
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
He said Apache was as inspiring to him as this is so Pete, as his first orgasm, you know. And
none more Pete.
But he said it's Bruce was the reason he sees himself even today as a rhythm guitarist.
That's really interesting, it's something I want to talk to Bruce about. But yeah, right, because it's that strident acoustic, which of course we know and love Pete for.
Yagadang. I think it was a kind of, you know, the Apache, if you listen to the Apache acoustic, you know, he's ding-a-ding-ding.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking more, you know, Pinball Wizard.
Of course. So, you know, absolutely huge. And it's very nice of Bruce to come on and to solve a little mystery, do you think, Guy?
Oh,
the
maybe.
Red Strat.
Could this be contentious?
It might be. So basically, would you tell the story, you know?
I can't remember. We're talking about the Red Strat.
Yeah, which Cliff bought and Hank played.
And now Bruce has.
Bruce has.
But it's, whenever I've seen it mentioned, it just gets skirted around, doesn't it? What makes us different, Gary?
Well, he did say that he stole it. He actually said, I stole it. But he's quite right. We're going to ask him, but he probably believes that it's Cliff's guitar, really, at the end of the day. And it was, you know, the first Stratocaster ever to be brought in to the UK. It was like this arrival of the piece of the cross, isn't it, really?
It is.
No, I mean, how important is it?
No, absolutely. It's so important. And the fact that it's red as well. There's something about the blood of our saviour, I don't know, Buddy Holly or whatever.
This goes out on a Sunday.
So I just find it interesting that I would have thought, because Cliff got the catalogue, didn't he? He got the little, and it was a very small little catalogue that you had to send off for and get from California. And
you have catalogues, don't you? You get all your clothes.
I get everything from catalogues.
But in those days, people got guitars. No, I mean, but you're right.
But I would have thought that, I'm sure if it was me or you, Gary, is that you would flick through that category and through that catalogue. And as soon as you saw a sunburst, you'd be like, oh, come on. Because you've never seen that before. You've never seen a sunburst on anything.
No, that's true. That's true. But they chose the Fiesta Red, didn't they?
Because they did.
That was Buddy Holly's guitar.
Yeah.
Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock On Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I've been sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock On Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Hello, Bruce.
Hi, Bruce.
Pretty high. How are you, Guy?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Good. I can see you two.
Can you see us?
I can see both of you, yeah, but when you get to 82, you don't want to be in shot.
I saw you not that long ago and you look fabulous. You've still got all that hair to be envious of. I mean, look at us two.
Exactly.
You know,
in fact, don't look at me too closely because I banged my eye with my sunglasses and I look like I've been in a fight.
I've got two of these though. One of them's always in the wash, you know, the hair.
You know, I rewatched, and I know guys watched it, that fantastic Shadows at 60, that's the documentary film on the BBC.
Yeah.
And it's just so, you know, it reminds us how you guys invented everything that we are now doing today. I mean, you know, your influence on the Beatles, your influence on people like David Gilmour and Pete Townsend and that whole generation, which have obviously passed the baton on to us. And
well, it was Hank, of course, as you well know. It was Hank, you know, his amazing guitar playing.
Well, that's very generous of you, Bruce. But as Gary was pointing out in that documentary, for instance, Pete Townsend says for him it was you.
He does, yeah. But he'll say anything.
No, he says, you know, and he is right. You know, Pete sees himself as a rhythm guitar player. And that's who you were. And you were inventing that genre, really, weren't you, you know?
I guess so, yeah, I guess so. I didn't realise it at the time, but I guess so, yeah.
Well, also, I'm going to put something to you, Bruce, that I think because it was very, very generous the way you... Because a lot of it was acoustic, but it's the rhythm guitar in the Shadows really was rhythm guitar. It was playing the chord. It's not like the Stones where everyone gets to play the fun riff. It was like Hank was doing all the single note stuff, you're doing the chords. And I reckon it's that sort of generosity and care for the arrangement is what made you, is part of why you became a very good and successful producer, because you care about the whole more than anything.
Yes, and also I hear the whole. Obviously, as a producer, you hear the whole, don't you? You don't just, you know, you're listening. When I listen to records, for instance, and I'm telling people, I said, oh, can you see what the little triangle is doing in the corner here, you know? And most people just listen to a record and they're, it's a wall of sound, isn't it? But as a producer, of course, it sort of spoils you in a way. You're going, oh, I like what he's doing on the, you know, the left there.
Yeah.
Even the look of your band, you know, these, you know, four guys in suits and, you know, what did we end up with the Beatles? I mean, you know, Brian Epstein said, take the leather jackets off, lads, get into those suits, you know, and there's that great shot that footage at the NME Awards in 1964, which I, you know, we can talk about later on because it's a sort of pivotal point in rock music in many ways. It's the passing of the baton. You know, you guys play and you've got your four black suits and ties and you walk off and on come these kind of lookalikes, the Beatles, you know, and...
Well, I can't blame the suits on us as well. No, but Brian Epstein brought the Beatles to Liverpool Empire in the real early days, as he said, to see what a proper band looks like.
Wow.
But we were super booted by then, early days, you know, looking smart.
You'd been sort of rock and roll to begin with, haven't you? I mean, Cliff had had his, I mean, when it was with Cliff, because he was very much the Elvis styled, wasn't he?
I mean, early British rock and roll, really, you know. I'm being derogatory again, but yeah, we were a huge influence on the group boom, because I always say, you know, without the Shadows, probably there would never have been a group boom, because everybody wanted to play like Hank, and everybody wanted to play bass like Jet Harris, and, you know, Tony Meehan on drums, all that stuff. So I think that's what we created. Guys wanting to play like Hank and play like Jet and play, possibly play like me.
Yeah. And I can't think of another example of that actual breakaway, because it wasn't uncommon to have a lead singer and a backing band, you know, all throughout the 50s and 40s even.
Yeah.
But this moment when you actually break away as and form your own band and without a particular lead singer, and then of course you go into a chart battle with Cliff, you know,
a great chart battle.
Yeah, because
we were, are we talking about Apache, Gary?
Yeah, I am actually.
But we're talking about July 1960. So we'd been Cliff's backing band, Scumbags, from October 58 till July of 60. And that's when we had the number one with Apache. And that changed the Shadows' lives totally. You know, we became a huge name by ourselves. But the great thing was we always worked together. You'd have the Shadows would close. Once we'd had the hits, the Shadows would close the first half of the show. There'd be a 15-minute interval. And then Cliff and the Shadows would do the second half of the show.
Yeah, but promoters and managers love that.
Nice and easy.
You knocked Cliff off the top of the charts. Was that a Cliff Richard and the Shadows record you knocked off
Cliff
the charts?
Cliff and the Shadows. It was called Please Don't Tease, which I co-wrote, number one. So it was Cliff and the Shadows, number one, with Please Don't Tease. And we released Apache, and it knocked Please Don't Tease off the top of the charts. So.
Wow. But Cliff deserves a real kind of tip of the hat here, doesn't he? Because he was always incredibly generous in, like, he was saying you should be making records, right?
Yeah, he was always saying to, and I say always, everything happened so quickly, guys. It really happened quickly. You know, Hank and I came to London in April 58. We went to the Two Eyes. We met Cliff in September 58. Even then, Cliff was saying to Norrie Paramore, Norrie, I think you should listen to my band. You know, I think, and we made, Norrie signed us up probably in December of 58, because in January 59, we had our first single out.
By the way, your mention of the Two Eyes, this is where I get to play my little card, which is that, because the basement of the Two Eyes had actually been painted by my dad and Lionel Bart for a case of beer, because my dad co-wrote all those Tommy Steele records, Bruce.
Really? Rock with the Caveman.
Elevator Rock, Doomsday Rock, Little White Bull, Handful of Songs, yeah.
I didn't know that, but I knew Lionel had painted it because we met Lionel down the Two Eyes in 1958, and he was like a student then. He had jeans and he had bare feet. You know those Roman sandals where you tie the around it? That's what he looked like then. So he was, a bohemian to us in those days, you know.
Well, you might have met my dad. I mean, he was very much there. Mike Pratt.
Yeah, Mike Pratt. Yeah. Well, amazing. I didn't.
You know, do you know what then, Guy? Because this means that Bruce has some of your dad's artwork on his wall. Because you've got Bruce, haven't you? A couple of the pieces of the plaster, painted plaster work from the basement of the Two Eyes.
Absolutely. Lionel Bart and myself, they were going to pull the place down that afternoon. The interior, the cellar, they were taking it down to make the restaurant bigger. So Lionel and I went down and the guys were hacking at the wall, you know, that he'd painted and your dad had painted. And I took a bit of the wall. So I've got that in my toilet, you know, as a permanent reminder.
Well, you'll clearly be hearing from my solicitors.
That's fantastic. I'm not sure it's the bit your dad painted. I think it's probably Lionel.
We'll DNA test it.
Bruce, I mean, that's obviously what you've given us here is a little Precis potted history, but we should just be a little bit more detailed.
Yes,
and
of course.
Really sort of talk about how you grew up and what influenced you. Because you weren't even Bruce Welch, were you?
No, I was born Bruce Cripps, illegitimate, in 1941, in the war baby. Yeah, and my mum was Welsh, so I took her name. So I was thinking of being Buddy Cripps, and, you know.
I love that. Yeah, I've heard you say that before. Elvis Cripps.
Elvis Cripps, you know, it's not that ring, has it?
Well, I think he's a horror movie star.
The only Cripps was Sir Stanley Cripps, was, I think, not prime minister, but I don't know, some foreign minister or something at the time. So he could have been my dad.
But what was the sort of music that you grew up on, and how did rock and roll enter your life?
I probably started noticing songs with Guy Mitchell, Tennessee Ernie Ford, 16 Tons, Guy Mitchell, She Wears Red Feathers and a Hula Hula Skirt, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. That would have been about 54, maybe, 1954.
Well, yeah. And that's literally like 4 years before.
Yeah.
Because this really needs to be... It is really worth pointing out the fact that you were so, everyone was so young, but I don't mean to jump ahead, but it's only because, Gary, this is the thing that really gets me with these guys, is that we've spoken to lots of people who were very young entering, like, you know, going into band situations. But the thing with you guys, like with you and Hank going down, everyone was totally young. You didn't have a grown up in the room at all.
No, we were 16.
Yeah.
Straight from school. And off to London, you know.
But what was that first rock and roll record then that you turned your head?
Oh, probably 55, Bill Haley, probably, Rock Around the Clock.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't miss it. Bill Haley, and I think in many ways has been written out of history because he looked like your bank manager, not a rock star, you know.
Well, and he was but especially to you guys, he must, I mean, he was what, 34?
He was 34 when he made it.
Which must have been unimaginably old to you.
I mean, he could have been our father, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know.
Could have been your granddad almost.
It could have been granddad, yeah.
Weren't there stories of people of the movie, going to the movie house and ripping up the chairs? Was that?
Absolutely. Was that? They did, yeah. The Blackboard Jungle, they played Rock Around the Clock in the Blackboard Jungle. Great story. Quick story. Blackboard Jungle. Glenn Ford was the star of it. Big star, Glenn Ford. And his son loved music. Anyway, Glenn Ford said, I need a theme song to go in the film. And he'd heard something of Bill Haley's, which wasn't Rock Around the Clock. And his son, who was about 15, said to him, I think you should use this song, Dad. You know, and it was Rock Around the Clock. And I went to the cinema, you know, when I was 14, I was 1955, 56. And the Teddy Boys were tearing the place to bits when Rock Around the Clock came on, jiving, you know, ripping up the seats. And that was in Newcastle.
Oh, but Bruce, I've said this on Rock on Tours before, and it's something I think is important, is that I think the reason everyone went so mad at those film screenings was not only hearing that music, but it was the only chance anyone would have had to hear it at that volume.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it was, well, I'm talking to two pros. It was just new. It was so new. It was exciting. Nobody had heard this sort of stuff before. No one. You know, and then from Haley, we had, you know, Fats Domino and Little Richard and all the others came. And for two kids like Hank and I'm sure Hank has mentioned all this before, at school, you know, and Lonnie was the king here. Lonnie was the catalyst. Us playing, because I used to read everything. First of all, the reason I got the two eyes, or we went to it because I'd read Tommy Steele was discovered there. That's a different story, as you know. But Lonnie came with this music, you know, and he said, anybody can play this stuff, you know, and you only need two or three acoustics and this, that, and the other. Of course, we all went out and bought an acoustic. I went out to a sports shop when I was 14 and paid £4.19 and 6 for a guitar. It was my first guitar.
Where'd you get the money?
I borrowed it from my auntie. Well,
bless her. From a sports shop?
From a sports shop. So you'd imagine what sort of guitar it was. You couldn't press the strings down after the fifth fret.
I always wonder, because the football boots I got from Macari's were terrible. I was...
No, that was first guitar. Lonnie was the catalyst for all of us, really. And American rock and roll, obviously. But in this country... As you well know, the two of you, we had John and Paul in a skiffle group in Liverpool. Hank and Bruce were a skiffle group in Newcastle. The Hollies had a skiffle group in Manchester. Everybody was in a skiffle group. Jimmy Page was in a skiffle group.
Yeah, yeah.
My dad played at a skiffle night at the Albert Hall when he used to play with the Vipers and the Cotton Pickers.
I knew the Vipers well. Yeah.
Well, but
didn't your drummer, Brian Bennett, played with the Vipers, didn't he, for a bit?
That's right, I think he did.
Not professionally, I don't. Not Brian played with everybody because Brian Bennett was the house drummer at the Two Eyes.
Oh,
as much as you can be a house drummer, you know.
Well, with as much of a kit as you could get in that basement.
Well, you could only get the kit on one side. Yeah. Hank mentioned we could only get a little kit on one side of this stage. The stage was probably about 4 or 5 feet wide, and maybe 2 feet high.
There's some great footage actually of the Vipers playing there, and it's unbelievable. In fact, with my dad playing guitar, but it's and it is everyone's just completely. In everyone's laps.
If it's a colour shot of a drummer, it's Brian Bennett on drums in the corner.
Can I offer up an idea that Skiffle was very associated with railroaders and working blue collar workers, and you know, in Liverpool you've got the Dockers, you know, and up in Newcastle you guys, you know, it's a mining community. Was there a kind of sense that,
the shipbuilders, the shipbuilders, yeah.
And was there a sense of connection because of that, do you think?
No. I don't think
it would have been nice. It's my romantic
because
moving swiftly along.
That's the record, wasn't it? A record came out called Rock Island Line, and you heard it on the radio and went, whoa, what's that? What is that?
But that's the other thing, is hearing it, just hearing all these records. You know, there wasn't a Radio 1. I mean, no. You know, and there weren't pirate radio stations yet, Bruce. Where were you hearing them?
I would have seen Lonnie. We saw Lonnie, you know, living in Newcastle as a city, the City Hall. And Chris Barber and his jazz band would come.
Right.
And Lonnie Donegan was the banjo.
The interval. Well, he would do the interval, wouldn't he?
Yeah, but he was his banjo player. Oh, he's a fantastic banjo player.
That's right.
Hank plays the banjo. He learned the banjo, you know, he played banjo at school.
George Melly was the singer as well, wasn't he? And Chris Barber's band. Yeah.
And Natalie Patterson was the girl who Chris married. But I mean, it was a fantastic band. Lonnie would do his spot, his skiffle spot. And the famous story is, of course, Chris Barber, Lonnie said, I want to record this song. So he recorded it as Lonnie Donegan's skiffle group as part of Chris Barber's jazz band. And Chris paid him £7 to sing it. And that was his royalty.
Oh.
I mean, he was a little bitter about that, you know, at the end. Yeah.
So you formed a band up there, didn't you? And of course, you know, it was about railroaders, wasn't it? That was the train analogy.
There's a cafe in Newcastle Central Station called the Railroad.
Yeah,
must be the Railroad, because we used to go in. Have a cup of tea there, you know, 11 o'clock at night. It was a place that was open late. After we did one of our gigs in a pub where we got £2.
But hang on, so you're doing these gigs. I mean, if you're 16 when you go to London, how old are you when you start doing these gigs in Newcastle?
14, 15, 14. Learning the guitar as we went, you know, but listening to Lonnie, listening to his stuff.
Because Hank tells us that you were such an inspiration to him, because he remembers being in the school playground and seeing a group of kids.
Yeah.
All standing in a circle, and up above these kids was coming the headstock of a guitar, and he went over to it, and it was you playing guitar to them.
Yeah, it was a national steel.
Wow, that's posh.
God knows,
posh, isn't it? Isn't it?
It still is, isn't it? But yeah. I don't know where I got it from, and I certainly, you know what you're like as pros. I don't know where it went, but that was the catalyst for Hank and I. At school, you know.
What song were you playing? Do you remember?
Oh, I can't remember. No. Yeah. Summer Holiday, probably.
Already written.
Was it sort of by that point, were you hip to kind of Lead Belly or Big Bill Brunsey or anything
Hank
like that?
Hank was into all of that. I was into, for want of a better word, the more commercial stuff, which was Lonnie. You know, skiffle started in the, it's an American music. You know, where did skiffle come from? It's black music from the 20s and 30s in America. They used the word skiffle.
Well, if you look at the history of that song, Rock Island Line,
yeah.
It goes back to sort of the 1890s or something, doesn't it?
But, you know, Lonnie rewrote it as he did all of his best of hits, you know.
There wasn't really the equivalent, though. That was very British, wasn't it? That sort of do-it-yourself... Putting, you know, tea chests and strings together and making instruments like that.
Well, it's exactly the same ethos that became punk 30 years later. It's exactly same mindset of how do we get heard.
But we all did it, guys. We all did it. This was the new music. This was Lonnie. it all happened in 56. Elvis came in January 56. Heartbreak Hotel. Rock Island 9 was January 56. I mean, that was number one in America. Lonnie was number one in America with Rock Island. Amazing.
So how long was it before the 6-5 special started? No, I'm trying to think if that was...
Well, talking about quick things, we came to London. I'm sounding like a stuck record player. We came in April 58, knowing no one, didn't know anybody, didn't have any money. But we were on, Hank and I were on in a little band in June of... We were on 6-5 special.
That's extraordinary.
I mean, we were on TV.
But let's just tell me how you got there, because you were going to London, weren't you, to do a competition?
Yeah, it was a thing called Sid Dale's National Skiffle Competition, you know. And but I'll tell you
was
what.
Was he Jim Dale's dad or something? No.
I don't know.
All
right. I can't remember, actually. He may well have been.
Probably. I mean, probably. You know what I mean?
I have a vague memory it was Jim Dale's dad.
But people had this great scam, Sid Dale, one of them, where those days, before your time, every town had a variety theatre. You know, we were in variety. We started in variety. We didn't start in the music business, because there really wasn't a music business as we think of it now. And Sid Dale could go around and actually had Jim Dale on. So Jim Dale had a big hit record. Be My Girl or something like that was called. But what they did, they auditioned. They get to, you know, they play a week in a town like Newcastle. They would audition local skiffle bands and say it was a competition. So all the five or six groups got free support. Yeah, free support. So five or six local bands would get up hoping to go to glory. And of course, nothing happened to them. And then Jim Dale, I think, probably came on and did, well, I definitely saw Jim Dale, so he probably did about 20 minutes, top of the bill. But get back to London, we lost the competition to an opera singer, I think a Malaysian opera singer.
What kind of competition is that? I thought it was a skiffle group competition.
They're casting the net pretty wide there, aren't they?
The con, isn't it? It's another clever con, really. Anyway,
did she have an orchestra with her? I mean, how did that work?
No, it would be a little group. No. Actually, probably just a piano.
I've never heard of an orchestra group.
No.
Of an opera group, sorry.
We went, when the other guys went home the next day, Hank and I went to the Two Eyes. So from about April the 8th of 58, we spent time in the Two Eyes all day, every day. We didn't have anywhere else to go. We loved the atmosphere, musicians coming in. Can I play? Have a little jam session? Can I do this with you? Kind of sit in and all that stuff.
But you'd had, unless you want to tell again, we know apparently you lucked upon a kindly Geordie landlady.
This is Bowman.
You in, right?
This is Bowman. Holly Park, near Finsbury Park, took us in after the manager, bless him, Mr. Livingstone it was. He said, so what are you doing, guys? You know, because I got out of Newcastle East. Where are you going? I said, I don't know. He said, well, where are you staying? I said, this is 10 o'clock at night in Edmonton. You know? And I said, well, we don't know. We haven't got anywhere. And he said, are you serious? I said, yeah. So he said, hang on a minute. He came back about 10 minutes later. He said, I know this lady who runs a boarding house in Finsbury Park. And he said, I've called her and told her there's two Geordies who I've got nowhere to go. And Mrs. Bowman was a Geordie. And she said, bring them back here. And we went back there and stayed in her attic for about 6 months.
And you're still there to this day, aren't you?
What did you owe the rent?
I don't know. Were you brought up by your parents? I mean, what did they think? Or were you living with your mum?
Your mum, sadly,
died very young.
What did they think? You just phone home and say, we're not coming back. What did go crazy?
No. Mum had died, so I didn't know mum. She had TB and couldn't cure it in those days. Right. Dad was had gone missing, so I was brought up by my aunt Sadie in Newcastle, that side of Newcastle. So, you know, how did we go and when we do it? When we left school, we just said, we are going to London, auntie. We just this is what we want to do. We were caught up in music, as it was, you know, skivvle and rock and roll.
There was something, sorry to interrupt, you didn't just go down to London for this competition and then stay the night. You kind of had a vision that that's where you were going.
Well, we just wanted to be in this business, I guess, in this rock and roll business, in this skivvle, you know, skivvle come rock and roll. We just wanted to be in it. We wanted to be part of it. We had no idea how to do it. And then a lovely friend of ours, Chaz, became a lovely friend. You've heard of Chaz McDevitt and the record Freight Train. It's a people group. Number one in America, number one here, number one. So we used to go and see, I told you about the theaters that every city had. Newcastle Empire was where all the stars came, a big star every week. And Chaz McDevitt came to play. We watched him as well. We watched Lonnie. We watched all the people. And there was a club they went down to after the gig, you know, and they were probably 30-year-old guys then, you know. And they had about three acoustic rhythm players, fantastic washboard player. And so we went down to this club. Now, we would still only be 15. And got talking to Chaz. He was very, you know, I mean, to us, he was a big star. He'd just been top of the bill. And he was very kind. And I said, Mr. McDevitt, you know, Hank and I, we'd just love to be doing what you're doing, you know. It must be so exciting. You know, 1 week you're in Newcastle, next week you're in Manchester, then you're in Liverpool, and you're, yeah. And we'd love to, you know, be in what you're doing. And he said, you'll never do it from here. You'll never do it from Newcastle. You would have to go to London. Mm. So that was the catalyst from that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
There's two things that bring tears to my eyes, Bruce. And that's Paul meeting John at that, you know, and seeing John play in the Quarrymen.
Yeah.
And that first meeting when John tested him. And then there's this image of these two young 15, 16-year-old Geordie boys getting themselves from Newcastle down to London. Yeah. And how we've all grown out of that. That, you know, Guy and I wouldn't be sitting here with our band, and none of this would have probably happened if those two events hadn't have happened. And just to say thank you, Bruce, as well.
Yeah, it's true. Because what would have happened is that Gary and I would be on tour sort of supporting ventriloquists and jugglers. Do you know what I mean? Because nothing would have changed.
Yeah, no, we did all that.
Being put on by Sid Dale's great-grandson. Or
Shadows did a tour. We did a nightclub once, and an elephant was a second top. Baby elephant. Seriously.
Wow. Following that.
Yeah.
So just what about this Two Eyes Club? Because I just want a bit more detail, really.
Okay.
You know,
it was all coffee bars, wasn't it? This is the great thing about Denmark. It was Old Compton, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because there was literally another coffee bar next door. And then there was another one two doors down. There was the one with the coffins and everything.
Oh, yeah, all of Heaven and Hell, yeah.
Yeah.
But the Two Eyes was owned by two Iranian brothers. And then it was owned by two wrestlers, Australian wrestlers. And they become friendly to us once they knew we'd come from London. Came down to London. They were kind. They let us play there and all that stuff. But it was like it was much smaller than the Cavern. It was, you know, hot and sweaty. You know, the old sweat running down the walls. there was no air down there, and they could probably get probably 100 people down there, crammed down there. We probably played there, I don't know, four nights a week, maybe. They let us play four nights a week, which is, when I say play, singing, you know, Elvis and Buddy Holly and the Everlys and everything, you know, Lonnie songs, the music of the day. That's what we
did.
And
were you the Drifters then? Were you the Drifters?
No, we weren't even the Drifters then.
Still the Railroaders.
We were still, Bruce and Hank, the Geordie Boys. We were known as the Geordie Boys. But you've got to remember, Hank and I come from Newcastle. Now, Newcastle was grey, you know, dark, open sites still there, you know, shipyards with the big work and the pits and all that stuff. And we came down to Soho, Old Compton Street, and the place was buzzing, you know, lights, Italian coffee shops, you know. First time I saw two guys kissing each other, I thought he was giving them a kiss of life in the doorway. but it was just so exciting. But this place was famous because Tommy Steele had come from there. We read it in the Daily Mirror, so it must be true. Well, that's why we went to the Two Eyes.
But there must have been, there was a parallel, wasn't there? There was a parallel jazz scene, not the trad scene. Wasn't there a sort of cutting edge bebop jazz thing happening as well? Or was that just a completely another world that you didn't really?
We wouldn't understand it. We couldn't play it. So there was a jazz club, a modern jazz club called The Nucleus, which is in Endell Street. And trad jazz was huge. I mean, in all the clubs.
Yeah, trad was, yeah.
It was big, 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 big. And
it's trad, Dad.
Trad, Dad. They made a movie, didn't they? It's trad.
Was it the hand jive supposedly invented in the Two Eyes because there was no room to dance?
Yeah, you couldn't dance. It was, you know, you're standing shoulder to shoulder. But yeah, everything was tight. It was like the cabin. You couldn't really dance in the cabin either.
When did Cliff appear down there?
Right. So Hank and I weren't playing or singing that night. Hank wasn't there that night. I'm doing the orange juice for, you know, Fiddle with Money.
Doing the orange juice.
And this guy came down and I didn't, I wasn't introduced to him. I was just still doing the orange juice. And it was Cliff and his Drifters, his friends, the Drifters. And he looked amazing. I mean, he had the sideburns. He was born in India, so he's, you know, swarthy skin. And he was just really, really good, really exciting. And I went back to Hank and said, some guy in tonight, you know, it was called Cliff Richard, you know. And that would have been really early on. That would have been in April, probably. So we hadn't been in the Two Eyes very long. Because Cliff didn't, I think he only played there once. And that's when I was there. So he didn't do a season or anything like that.
Okay, well, that's handy. That's handy that you were on the orange juice machine that night, isn't it?
Yeah, but I didn't sort of meet him or say hello. It was months later that his manager, in inverted commas, came down, you know, looking for a great guitarist.
We could just get the timeline right. Had Move It come out before he played it twice?
Move It came out in September of 58.
Right, right.
Now, late September. Hank was in the Two Eyes in September, probably halfway through September. Some guy, you know, practicing, playing, having a laugh with mates. And a guy came down and said, I'm looking for this guitarist, Tony Sheridan. He's heard about Tony Sheridan. There were two great players in the Two Eyes, Hank Marvin and Tony Sheridan. Really good, really, really good. And Tony wasn't there. So he said, oh, I'm looking for a lead. This guy said, I'm looking for a lead guitarist for Cliff Richard. So it was sort of, well, who's Cliff Richard? Nobody knew who he was, really. So Hank said, well, I'll play you. So Hank sat and played him some licks, you know. He could play the intro to That'll Be the Day. If you could play that, you were, you know, a great guitar player.
Oh, but you've often said is that he was the one guy who could play single notes.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He knew where the next one was coming from as well. He knew where to go. So this guy said to him, I've got this 3-week tour coming up. Love you to do it. And Hank said, do you need a rhythm guitar player? Yep. You know, Bruce is a really, really, really good guitar player, rhythm guitar player. And he said, yeah, fine. If you're going to bring him along. So I got there and we went around a corner into Dean Street. We went up a flight of stairs to a tailor. And Cliff was standing there with his arms outstretched, you know, like Jesus on the cross, having his pink jacket made. Hank and I are 16. pimples, sweaty, Cliff 17, pimples, sweaty. And he said, can you come back to my house and have a rehearsal? I guess it was an audition. We didn't really feel that. But so we slapped on a bus out to Cheshunt in Hertfordshire to his council house where he lived with mum and dad and three sisters. We went in the front room. You know, the front room was the posh room.
Yeah.
We sat and played everything we could think of, you know, Ricky Nelson, My Babe and all that stuff, Gene Vincent, Buddy Holly, Everly's. And Cliff said, yeah, great. He said, that's it. He said, love you to do it. The two of us for 3 weeks. And that was it.
You've told a story about Move It before, Bruce, but where it's the same as the story you said about, I can't remember earlier, about another song where it was down to someone's kids is why that was the A-side.
Yeah, no.
Wasn't it?
Absolutely true story.
Yeah.
Evidently, Cliff had recorded Move It. Well, I know he'd recorded, but Norrie was the producer, you know, God. He was a God, the producer. And Norrie said, we're doing Schoolboy Crush as the A-side, which was a cover of an American hit. Because in those days, if you're old enough to remember, a lot of English pop stars, for want of a better word, covered American hit. That's how they had hits. And so Cliff did Schoolboy Crush and Move It on the same session. And of course, Move It, fantastic record, still a fantastic.
Yeah, look, first British rock and roll record.
Ernie Shearer on guitar and a session bass player, Frank Clark on bass, and Terry Smart. And Cliff said, they listened to it, and Norrie said, great, that's great, Schoolboy Crush. And Cliff said, oh, Norrie, you know, this is so special, this record, you know. And he kept badgering me, and you couldn't really badger your producer, you know, when you're 17, you couldn't give him a hard time. So he said, I'll take it home, play them to my kids, the girls, and I'll let you know. And the girls chose Move It. 2 years later, same story with Apache. Norrie said to us, Quartermaster Stores is going to be your next A-side. So we said, well, we've got this tune, Apache. Okay, we'll record Apache. So we did Apache, same thing. Hank with the echo box for the first time. Fantastic, tickety-tick, you know, all the echo. Me on acoustic guitar by then, huge. I borrowed Cliff's J200. Rang, da-da-da, rang, da. And same thing. And we said, oh, great, this is really unusual. It's really good. And he said, no, Quartermaster Stores will be the A-side. And we said the same thing. Norrie, please. He said, take it back to my daughters. He took it back to his daughters, played the two children, and they chose Apache. How's it?
Oh, my God.
I'm hoping that they grew up and went on to become some top A&R team.
They became Simon Cowell.
What was it like going back to Newcastle City Hall and playing there? I mean, you must have returned as kings. Did all your old mates turn out in your family?
Well, we'd gone, as I said, we left in April 58. The two other guys in the band, the Skiffle band, went home. They were slightly older than Hank and I. They were probably 20 years old. They went home. So in October, on this tour, we turn up at Newcastle City Hall. The Kaolin Twins were top of the bill. American, you know, that fantastic record, When. And Cliff and the Drifters came on. And, of course, Cliff was doing his Elvis with a pink jacket and the hands behind the head. And Hank and I are wheeling our legs and all that stuff at the front, you know, playing rock and roll. And the guys that had come home were sitting about five rows back in the audience, and half our classes from school were there, all watching. It was amazing. Just what you said, it was just amazing. I mean, I sang at Newcastle City Hall as a choir boy, you know, at school, you know. Amazing.
It was a great venue.
But because also, just thinking about what you were talking about making these records, Gary, you remember when you first went into the studio? And how, and you know, even for us, it was just doing demos and stuff, and how incredibly intimidating it was, and how out of your depth. And so, but you're making these records, and you're also, you know, this you and Hank and Cliff, your children. I mean, the pressure that must have felt like, or was it just kind of, well, did it feel completely natural?
We didn't know, we were scared, you know, we went to Abbey Road,
yeah,
in November 58. But of course, then, Abbey Road wasn't the famous Abbey Road it is now.
Well, no, it was EMI Studios. And in fact, it was EMI Studios until the Beatles made Abbey Road. That's why it's called Abbey Road.
But it was just scary, But we didn't make demos in those days. We didn't make demos. We didn't have anything to make a demo on. The demos were the records, you know.
Yeah. It was Studio Two, wasn't it? Studio Two.
Studio Two, yeah.
And what was the first? What was the first record that was a hit for you?
We played on a thing called "Living Love and Doll."
Oh right. Record.
Not a huge hit, but it was the first one.
God, yourself for crying. Yeah.
No, that's Living Doll. That's Living Doll.
That's Living Doll. This is Living Love and Doll. This was
Living Love and Doll.
Oh, sorry.
End of 58.
Not to be confused with Loving Living Doll. Which,
You're getting me confused now.
Yeah.
No, but we were nervous. We hadn't been in the studio, you know. It was just
and it was guys in white coats, right, and biros in the pockets and stuff.
Brown coats with the technician brown. Who set the machines up and all that, you know. And we had a
good luck studio.
Yeah, good luck studio. I made the first couple of records, two or three records we made. I played electric guitar. I never liked the sound. It was just like a hum in the background, you know. Chords, C, A minor, F and G. It was just like a hum in the background behind Hank. I didn't like it. And when we came to Apache, I said to Cliff, because Cliff had bought this J200, we all went to see, we were going to tour South Africa. We're on the way to South Africa. The plane was late. So we went to the movie house and saw Elvis Loving You. And in the Loving You, he plays a blonde J200. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's on the album, isn't it? That's on the album cover.
Yeah, I've got to get one of those, just the same. So I said, can I borrow your acoustic, Cliff? And I borrowed the J200 and played it on Apache. And I used it on most of the hits after that because it was suddenly there was no hum in the background. It was just, I mean, you listen to the opening chords of Apache, you know.
Oh, yeah, fantastic. Yeah.
Right. Big.
No well, coincidence.
Do you also think it's probably not a coincidence that Pete.
That's what I was going to say. No, exactly. Yeah. Say that.
Great minds. That Pete Townsend has always played a
J200. Yeah, yeah. Great guitar.
And David Bowie. Whenever he played an acoustic, it was a J200.
Was it? Yeah.
Big sound.
And that became, with Hank, obviously, Hank with the Echo Box, him on his Echo Box, I played acoustic rhythm. And that was the essential sound of the Shadows in terms of guitars. I very, very, very rarely went back to play electric on a record.
Were the Everlys an influence at that point?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. On me, if we're talking about Bruce Welch, the biggest rhythm influences were the Everly brothers. I found out years later it was Don Everly. Don's the great player. Or he was the great player.
Right.
And of course, but
because hadn't you and Hank had entertained the notion of being a sort of Everly Brothers in terms of vocals, hadn't you?
We were everybody. We were the Everly Brothers. We were Elvis. We were.
Yeah. Who do you want us to be?
Sounding like idiots. But we copied everybody because you do. You know, everybody. You know what it's like when you start. You copy your heroes, don't you? You listen to their stuff and you want to be able to play like that. And when I heard Bye Bye Love, the intro to Bye Bye Love, and then I heard Wake Up Little Susie, you know, I thought, this is what I want to sound like. This is what, you know, acoustic.
Because the Everlys vocally were massive influence on the Beatles as well, weren't they?
Well, they were everybody. I mean, you could never top Don and Phil because they were family, they were brothers. So they had this perfect blend. They recorded on one mic. They just looked at each other slightly. You know, they were just looking at each other slightly when they sang. So they were always, the phrasing was like absolutely perfect. You know, you see it if you watch the their comeback concert at the Albert Hall about 1986 or 89. And you watch them and they just slightly look at each other with the phrasing. But it's Don playing all the clever, you know, bing, 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 all the stuff. So I said, that's what I want to be. I had Hank, my mate, playing all the clever widdly diddly stuff, inventing great solos of his own. And I said, I want to sound like that. I want to be a rhythm guitar player like that. And that's what I tried to become.
Because that sound was great. And actually, in the context of the time, your acoustic sound is kind of very advanced. I mean, they're really beautifully recorded. I don't know how much work went into. Did you sort of work on a way to record it, or, you know,
no
mic placement or whatever?
No, got the engineer did that. I played in a strange way. I would sit down and I would try to show you, but I can't show you. I would.
Oh yeah, I get it.
I'd sit up straight, play over the guitar. I didn't play rhythm. I sort of lay back a bit, so it was, the guitar was laying across my tummy, and I played sideways, if you like. You know, it looks strange. But the engineer would then come and put the microphone to where I am, the way I'm playing.
How was it presented to you? How did you know that? Was it given as a demo, or did Lionel play it?
I'll tell you the story. It's an unfamous story, but Cliff had made a movie called Serious Charge. I mean, this is how fast things worked in those days. We went on tour in October 58, right? He did a 3-week tour. In December, he was making a movie. I mean, it's just ridiculous, yeah. And from this Serious Charge film, he'd recorded with Norrie Paramore's sort of orchestra, brass and stuff. It sounded like an old Maid of Vale session, you know, trumpets and all that stuff. Got myself, so the film came out, and Cliff came and said, they want to release a single from the movie, you know. And we're thinking of Living Doll. I said, you can't release that pile of crap, Cliff. It's awful. It's an awful, you know, arrangement. It was just like a session, you know, like trumpets and strings. And I said, we should do it like this. And I sat down with his acoustic and just went, jing, 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 and got myself a crying. And that's what we did. That's how
More Evelies, in fact.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So there you are, producing. You see, Bruce?
Yeah, I just, well, not producing, yeah, but ideas. I certainly see you can't release that sort of BBC session type, you know, record, you know. It's awful. And anyway, it sold a million, so everybody was happy, you know. And I stuck with acoustic, you know, most of my career then.
And so how did you come to sort of decide you were going to make an instrumental and do it without Cliff? Was that Cliff's idea?
Whose
idea?
So much. Cliff had got us the deal. Norrie signed us. We had to provide. So the first single came out in January 59. A vocal. That was a flop. 3 months later, we put out a thing called Jet Black, which was Jet on the bass solo type of thing. Then another single came out. So we had three flop singles. And by now, we're into April of 1960. We're on the road, Cliff and the Shadows on the road. And there was a singer called Joey Lord, singer-songwriter, lovely man. And he said to these famous words, he said, will you guys be playing another single? Will you be doing another single anytime soon? And we went, yeah, every 3 months we have to. He said, can I play you this tune? And we said, yeah. So he went to, he came back with a ukulele and played, strummed on the ukulele. Ging, 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 ging. Down, 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 down. I went, whoa, love it. Love it. Can we play this to our producer, Norrie? Of course, then we finished the tour. We toddled back to Norrie and said, Norrie, listen to this. This is Apache, you know, this is such a... Yes, boys, we'll record that with Quartermaster Stores. You can do that with Quartermaster Stores. And that's the story, you know. We recorded both of them.
Yeah.
And his daughters picked Apache.
But because the thing with being an instrumental group, isn't it true to say, because I know you had a lovely thing a few years ago when you actually got up with him, but the kind of the Elvis for that is Duane Eddy.
Yeah, Duane, yeah.
You know, that's kind of he's the start point for that.
Because Duane came in September 58. I mean, very close, you know, we were October. He was September with Rebel Rouser.
Wow, is that close? God. Okay, so you're right.
That was that first guitar.
It's not like you admired him from afar for years already.
Oh, no. It was September. No. Yeah, okay. The day, something.
But there was that surf music sound, was that?
That came a little later.
This is more Western, isn't it? Because there's that whole kind of High Chaparral.
Dimmesdale came in the surfing thing in the early 60s with a beach ball and all that stuff. But Dwayne was the first, that fantastic. And he played the bottom four strings, you know.
Yeah.
And he recorded the echo in a container. He had a great, you may or may not know, that Lee Hazelwood was his. Lee Hazelwood was his producer.
Yeah.
He put the amp in this container and got that echo. Amazing.
Because Hank's delay came, was Joe Brown found him that, didn't he?
He did. We were playing up north somewhere. And anyway, cut a long story short, Joe is a very, he loves everything naturally. Like he just wants to play the guitar as it is. But he got this echo box, the Miazzi echo box. He said, Hank, I don't really like this. Do you want to try this this thing? And Hank tried it and loved it, all that tick, 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 you know. So Hank toddled off and got himself one of his first echo boxes. It was an Italian echo box. And that's what we used on Apache and all the other hits. That became Hank's sound.
Yeah, but it also goes on to become David Gilmour's sound. You know, everyone was inspired by that, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the Stratocaster, Bruce.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I was just playing an Icon before you came on, and now I'm talking to one. So, lots of love, mate. Fantastic.
Thank you very much.
The Stratocaster.
Yeah.
How long have we got? 2 or 3 hours?
What do you want? What do you need?
Do you want the truth? So,
is it there? Is it in the room with you? Is it in the room with you now?
Behind on its stand, yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Just talk us through these boys looking through the catalogue.
Cliff wanted to sound American. He wanted his guitarist to sound American. Now, we were listening to a guy called, Ricky Nelson's guitarist. We didn't know who he was. Because on Ricky Nelson's records, it says Ricky Nelson with instrumental accompaniment. It was James Burke.
James, right.
He was 16, so he's playing all this amazing stuff. We knew it was a Fender, but you know, we presumed it was a Stratocaster. Anyway, so we listened to him, Scotty Moore on Elvis Records, you know, all that stuff. So Cliff said, I want you to sound, you know, we were playing cheap guitars, really. Hank was playing an Antoria, a Japanese Antoria, you know, like one of the first electrics, a little horrible little thing. Again, when he got to the fifth fret, the strings were hard to put down.
Was that all German, wasn't it? Quality instruments were German, weren't they, back then?
No, Antoria was Japanese.
No, I know, but I mean, what I mean is that they were cheap Japanese, but because you weren't getting American guitars.
Yeah, you couldn't. I'll tell you why. It's a boring story. The Board of Trade, the English Board of Trade, put a ban on American instruments. And it was to do with, they wouldn't let, if an English band wanted to tour in America, you had to have an American band tour here, the Musicians Union type thing. So you couldn't go down Denmark Street and buy a guitar, an American guitar, you know. So Cliff said, I'm going to send to Fender in California because of Buddy Holly's guitar. And the catalogue came, opened the catalogue, went through it, and there it is in the center pages, this red Stratocaster maple neck. It was just unbelievable. You know, when we opened the box, you know, the cardboard box that came in. And it was just sensational. And Cliff bought it for Hank to play. He bought it. He probably gave it to him. But that's where I'm coming on to now. So that was Hank's sound. You know, he had the Echo Box, he had the Strat, you know, the first one in Great Britain.
Wouldn't have had it. So you wouldn't have had a Fender amp, though, would you? Wouldn't have had a Fender twin, no.
No, we couldn't. First of all, you couldn't have the money.
Couldn't get them, yeah.
Vox, AC30.
You're used to getting all these posh people, guy. That's your problem with, let's get a new amp, let's get...
No. I'm just saying, I know at the time it wouldn't have been, because, you know, in America, they all would have played a Strat through a Fender Twin.
That's right.
But of course you couldn't, because it was hard enough getting a Strat over. But the shipping on an amp would be... So you would have been playing, I guess, a Vox.
Cliff imported it, cost him 140 guineas, which is about 150 quid. Gave it to Hank. Played it on lots of records, all the big, massive records, Apache, all the hits, you know, Wonderful Land, FBI, all that stuff. And I don't know if Hank told you, but in the early days of touring, you couldn't hear a thing. We couldn't hear anything because Cliff was wiggling his legs. He was like the British Elvis and all that stuff. and there were no PAs. We didn't have any mics in front of the amps.
Yeah, no monitors.
No monitors. Yeah. We used house, whatever the house PA was, so you couldn't hear it. That kept going, and Vox, it's like the old story I was going to tell you. When you skin, you know, when you skin, you can't get anything for free. As soon as we made Apache and sold a million records, you know, what would you like, guys? Would you like some amps? Would you like some matching Fenders? Would you like this? And so they gave us a Vox 15, a little Vox. And we were out on tour again, and they screamed. We couldn't hear anything. We couldn't hear Cliff play. And Hank went to the Vox factory. He said, I can't hear myself. You know, it was so loud. He said, can you make me one of these, make it louder? So it was an AC 15. They put two speakers, and it became the AC 30.
Wow. So we have Hank to thank for the AC 30.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why do we not know this? This is amazing. Thank you. That's wonderful. That's a brilliant revelation.
Because he's a humble man.
Exclusive to Rock on Tours.
So without causing any trouble between mates, you know, how did you end up with the guitar, Bruce?
I'm going to tell you. Sit back and relax. So so get back to about where you couldn't get anything if you were skinny. As soon as you're famous, everybody gives you anything you want. So suddenly Fender said, would you like three red matching Strats? You know, the Fender bass, two Strats. Oh, yeah, that would look great. You know, we were in the suits by then. So Hank said to Cliff, here's your guitar. Cliff took the guitar back, and we had all this new free equipment. Brilliant. And it went on like that. And years go by, and I had the chance of producing Cliff, producing his records.
That's right. You were responsible for his reinvention, really. Yeah,
1975.
75, yeah.
He hadn't been in the charts for a couple of years, which was a long time for Cliff. Hits had dried up a bit. So his manager said, anybody who can come up with some great songs will have the chance of producing Cliff. So I went out asking all my songwriter friends, you know, have you got any great songs for Cliff? This, that, and the other. So I found three songs. One was called Miss Unites, one was called Devil Woman, and the other one was I Can't Ask for Any More Than You. So we went in the studio and did those three, and everybody was really, really happy. It was different sort of stuff. And the management at EMI said, we should make an album. We made an album called I'm Really Famous. That was the album. And so I'm at Cliff's house one day in his garage where his music was, playing him song. And I said, where's the guitar, Cliff? What happened to the guitar? You know, I haven't seen the guitar in 14 years or something. He said, it's under the stairs. And I'm not sure, this is the thing, I can't remember if it, I said, can I steal it off you or can I use it? Anyway, he gave it for me to use. That was 1975, and I've still got it. Still played it. I've played it on tours with him. I played it on records with him. Wow. And there's a great thing about the guitar and Hank and Cliff and myself. He has never in, 40-odd years, asked for the guitar back. Because if he'd said, literally like that, can I have my guitar back, I would have given it to him. Because I didn't pay for it. So we go on another, I'm coming up to 82 now. A couple of years ago, he rang up. He was in town from Barbados. He said, can I take you and Brian to dinner? So I said, great.
He said, your manager, right?
Go to the Ivy. And I said, the Ivy? Oh, great. Okay. Rang Brian. He said, I'll let you know where. So we get a message. It's the Ivy Marlow. So it cost me 90 quid in a cab there, 90 quid in a cab back to have dinner. But as we were leaving, he said, should we just talk about it? Because this is a couple of years ago. Should we talk about the guitar? And I said, yeah. And Brian Bennett was there, and his Cliff's friend was there. He said, why don't we? He said, why don't you know? If you go first, if you die first, you know, if you go first, leave it to me. And if I die first, I'll leave it to you. And we shook hands on that. So I'm just hoping, you know.
Don't hope. Don't go there, Bruce.
I mean, it's got to be one of the most valuable guitars in the world, right?
Yeah, it is. It is.
What I want to talk about now, and what I think, you know, what we're interested in really is this moment when because you were this massive band. I mean, Cliff still I think Cliff still has is number four in the all time charts of who's had number ones. I think Elvis is first.
Well, him and Elvis had the before the Beatles, obviously. Him and Elvis ran the show.
Yeah, but that moment when you end up in pantomime with Cliff doing Aladdin or something, and it's a big job. I mean, it's with Arthur Askey, isn't it? It's at the London Palladium.
Yeah, 16 weeks, twice.
But that sense that you were going into being pushed in a certain way into variety, and into light entertainment, where there was this kind of upspring of the Beatles and what was going on.
I know what you're saying, Gary, but I have to say, very early on in our conversation, you're imagining the music business as we are now, as it was.
Yeah.
It wasn't like that.
Yeah.
There were variety theatres. There were variety shows. By then, the Beatles had happened. So there were what we call package shows, as you know, where you get five or six acts from the 60s. That sort of thing was going on.
But
we would never do that because the Shadows could fill a show by ourselves. Cliff could do it by himself. But somebody says, 16 weeks at the Palladium. The Palladium was probably still is the place to play for many people. It was the biggest place. I'm not talking about the arenas that we all know now. I'm talking.
Well, that's the thing, that the kind of the big gigs as we know them didn't exist. Yeah. There were just those theatres, weren't
there?
Yeah.
Liverpool Empire, 3,000, I think. That was like a huge place. Because most of the gigs we play, like Newcastle City Hall, it would be, 1,000 or 1,200 people, something like that,
Yeah.
I get what you're saying, Bruce. That was just the direction that seemed natural. I mean, there is a moment, though, isn't there, when you go and see the Beatles play with Hank, and don't you end up back at your house?
Yeah.
Tell us the story.
The house, yeah. Well, they'd had... we all loved Love Me Do, which was, I think, October 62. Loved that, didn't know who they were. And then 2 months later, Please, Please Me came out. We went, wow, who are these guys? Got to go and see them. So we went down to Lewisham. Hank and I went to Lewisham in South London. And of course, we were, for want of a better word, famous, And I said, fantastic. They were, screaming and all that stuff. I said, do you want to come back to my house? I live in North Harrow. Why don't you come back and have a few drinks and stuff? So they said, yeah, great. So Hank and I went back. I told Cliff. Cliff came. They must have got cars there. Anyway, we're having a little party. Well, I say a party, drinks on the stairs, and curly sandwiches, and all that stuff. And they got round to it, and I said, they said, have you got any guitars here? I said, yeah, I've got a couple of acoustics. And they said, well, what's your next single going to be? And I said, well, we'll play it for you. So Hank and I sat with acoustics on the stairs, and it happened to be Foot Tapper, from the Summer Holiday film. This is going to be our next single. And they went, do you want to hear our next single? And they went, if there's anything that you... if there's anything I can do...
Oh, what a moment.
And we went, yeah, it's okay. Wow. It's quite nice. She liked that sort of stuff. true story.
That's amazing.
That is amazing.
But we were friends then. Everybody was friends then. The act, we were on the road. We'd meet in the Blue Boar on the M1. 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, coming back from Liverpool and Manchester and all these places.
Oh, on the A roads. This is all pre-motorway, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah. I mean, there was a moment, obviously, when there was a disappointment in that it wasn't sort of happening for the Shadows anymore. And you quit the business, didn't you?
I did. Well, that was 10 years later. I mean, we started in 58, December 68. Funny enough, it was the Palladium again. I was with... Olivia Newton-John, she was my love. And I thought we'd done absolutely everything a band could do. We'd toured the world two or three times. We'd had lots of hits. We had 30-odd hits.
And hit movies.
35 with Cliff. And I just wanted to spend time with Olivia. So I said, I gave them everybody notice. And I said, I'm going to leave after the Palladium. So that was great. We had a great time, a great season there, finished that. And then I was with Olivia, swanning around the world, doing whatever. And 2 years went by, and I said to Hank, do you fancy doing something different? You know, can we not the shadows, not the shadows. And he said, yeah. And of course, that time, 1970, was James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Pye and Mash, all that stuff.
I've got to say, because that's one thing which I didn't really know about until we had Hank on. Yeah. I've got to say that stuff is, it's fantastic. Yeah, it really you are is. Such a, it's so Crosby, Pye and Nash.
Well, that was Laurel, you know, Laurel Canyon. But
yeah, Newcastle. And it's great stuff, that.
But we did it. We did a couple of albums, couldn't get arrested, because every time we walked on, they'd say, play as FBI, Hank.
Yeah.
Play as Apache, yeah. Hank. Play as Wonderful Land, Hank.
Yeah.
We couldn't get away with it. So
it's but great harmonies, and your voice was great in the three acoustic guitars, and then there's that sort of psychedelic stuff like Simplify Your Head, or you know.
But John Farrar, bless him, we brought John from Australia. He'd been on a support. He had a band in Australia called The Strangers. We were touring Australia. They were a support act, and we used to just sit and watch them at the side of the stage. And go, my, who is this guy, John Farrar? You know, fantastic voice, fantastic player. So when we decided to do something, I said to him. Well, Hank said, actually, wouldn't it be nice to have a third voice, like another harmony? And Olivia said, what about John, you know, John Farrar? I said, oh, do you think he'd be... I said to Hank, should I call him? Because Olivia was friends with him. So call John in Australia. Do you fancy coming to the UK and joining a band? And he did. And that was me. He came. I was...
That's quite a punt, isn't it? I mean, it's a long way.
Yeah, big deal. Big deal to come. And so he came, lived with me for a year, and we did the albums and we did a little bit of touring. But he was the brains with the harmonies. He was a proper muso. He could read the dots. You know, I don't know what it was like when you started, Gary, but I've got the high voice, so I sing chest voice. But I would just busk all the harmonies. You know, if Cliff's singing the melody, let's say, do you want to dance with? Make it easy, you know. So I'd sing ding, 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 just the harmony. And so when John came and we'd written these songs, and I'd start to sing a harmony, and John said, no, that's not quite right, Bruce. I need you to sing this note and that note. And I said, no, I've always been singing this sort of, I always do it myself, John. He said, yeah, but if you want my third voice on there to make this chord sound fantastic on the top, you have to sing this note. So this is what he did. He vocally arranged the Marvin Welsh and Farrar stuff and played the guitars.
Did he write You're the One That I Want in Greece?
He wrote Have You Hopelessly Devoted to You. He wrote Have You Never Been Mellow. Lots and lots of Olivia's massive hits.
Wow.
And it was her producer, you know, producer till she died.
And suddenly, though, Bruce, the sort of, it was okay to like The Shadows, wasn't it? Came full circle, and everyone admitted that you guys were the massive influence that you were.
It came back. I can't remember exactly. We did a John Peel show as Marvin Welsh and Farrar and a bass player. And I think it was John had said to him, you should, you know, The Shadows were so iconic, and there was a time recently in the 60s, late 60s, whatever, it wasn't cool to like The Shadows, you know, you're uncool. He said, but that sound you had and all that, you should go back and do that sort of thing. So that's how it transpired. And we finished up doing, you know, talk about doing variety. We agreed to do the 1975 Eurovision Song Contest. And we did, the public chose the song at the end of the day, the public. Not the punters in the music business.
You were on the Lulu show, weren't you?
Yeah, we did a song a week. So there were six songs. We recorded six songs. And they do one. We did one every week. And then the public voted. And that's how we got the song, Let Me Be the One. And so that song, I think, was top 10. It brought The Shadows back in the singles chart for the first time in, I don't know, 8 or 9 years, probably. We did a few little concerts. And... then
is this before the iconic album?
Yeah, well, the couple of years went by. EMI said to us, we're going to re-release all of your hits, the, you know, the mono I said, really? He said, yeah, but we're putting it on TV. It's the new marketing thing. We're going to put it on television. Really? Who's going to buy, you know, mono hits or, you know, 20 years old hits and all that? They said, well, we believe in it. Anyway, so EM in 1977, they put out The Shadows, 20 Golden Greats, it was called.
So I think it's the first advert to ever feature someone playing air guitar.
That's it, yeah, yeah, all that stuff, yeah. So we said, well, good luck. We're a bit worried about the album. Anyway, it sold 1.25 million in the UK. We hadn't sold that many albums once. And EMI said to us, you'd be crazy not to follow this up. Mm-mm. You know, you've got to go out and work and play to your audience. And we went out and played, and everywhere was full. Everywhere was packed. It was actually bigger than the first time round. It got bigger than the first time. You know?
And then this led to you doing 2 Wembley stadiums with Cliff, right?
With Cliff, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It became our, when was it? We did it in 86, I think. 86. Two beautiful days in June. And so it was supposed to be our 30th anniversary, whatever. So Cliff said, I'm going to do this. And he said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get the old boy show together. I'm going to get the artists from Old Boy, which is the show he started on.
Fantastic.
And so he said, it'll be Cliff and the Shadows and the Old Boy show. And we went, okay, great. The first row we had, Cliff said, I'd like you guys to be in the, you know, like in the first half hour, you know, during the Old Boy show. And we said, no, we're not going to be playing one number in the Old Boy show. You know, we're already going to close the first half with the Shadows hits, you know, and then we're going to close the second half with you. And we don't want to be an Old Boy. So there was a bit of a...
Quite right.
He got miffed.
Absolutely.
He got Jet Harris and Tony Meehan to come and play. So Jet and Tony turned up and played. It was just a great 2 days, fantastic 2 days. Yeah. That was the first time we played arenas like that.
We should leave you on that high, really, shouldn't we?
I think so, yeah. That was,
I haven't started.
Fantastic, Bruce.
I haven't started.
He's warming up.
Oh, yeah. We're doing a series. Oh, it is a series, isn't it?
Bruce, is the music still in your life? Are you still strumming?
I still strum, yeah. I've got arthritis, unfortunately, in my left hand badly, my right thumb, so it stops me playing. I couldn't play like I used to play. You know, I'd be letting people down to try and do, you know, I try and be as good as I was. Let's put it that way.
So, actually, Bruce, of course, it is seeing as you got the red Strat, do you have the J200 that you used on all the records?
Cliff still has it.
Oh, okay.
Tight bastard, wouldn't give it to me.
Oh, the red Strat wasn't enough.
Bruce, so I think we've sorted the red Strat out.
You have.
I think we have. I think we have.
Let's hope that decision hasn't got to be made for many years.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Bruce, such a pleasure having you on. Bruce, apparently you were sitting about 4 rows in front of me at Wembley watching Arsenal.
I can't believe we didn't see each other in the same aisle.
Beat Man City.
Oh,
yeah. You probably couldn't see over his fabulous coif.
I didn't recognise the singer singing that 100,000 people. I couldn't.
I know. I was very happy to.
Magic. Unbelievable magic.
One of the Arsenal fans have sing one of my songs, Gold, for Zinchenko, and I managed to video half of the Wembley Stadium singing that song at full pelt. That was
fantastic.
Really emotional for me. Really emotional.
This was against Man City.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So have they got a song based on a Duran Duran?
I hope you rang the PRS during the.
Great, great, great. I'm sure people could on social media could tell us what that song would be to what player in Man City.
It was a magic moment, wasn't it? Especially for you. I mean, it was just unbelievable. All the people singing your song. Yeah.
It was. Bruce, thank you, and I'll see you at the end of the year at we're both sods, aren't we, songwriters?
Yeah.
Whatever it is.
And I'm sorry you never got
Society of Distinguished Songwriters.
Bands, guy, you know, I was reading your CV.
What's that, sir?
I'm a bit sorry you never really got to play with any famous names, you know.
Well, yeah, thanks. You know, yes, you can still dream, can't you, Bruce?
I've never seen so many huge bands you play. Fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, That was great.
That was fantastic.
Yeah, so many exquisite stories that were so evocative and black and white.
Yeah.
The fact he's got a piece of potentially your dad's sort of...
I know,
the collab that he did with Lionel.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Oh. I don't know if they did murals or it was just Paris by moonlight.
No, there's footage of it. There's footage of that downstairs area. I mean, you can see it in the shadows at 60 Dock that's on iPlayer. And there's footage of that whole wall in the background, sort of orangey with...
Oh, that's right. Yeah, but yes, orangey. But there's also, I think, wasn't there a sort of slightly sort of Greek beach scene or something painted a bit on one side?
Is that really? Really? You were the model for that, were you? Oh, no, you weren't even born. You weren't even a twinkle in his...
I wasn't, though.
Boxes.
In his orange juice.
I just really have that. And if anyone wants to compare notes, there's the Hank Marvin episode that we did in lockdown.
And do you know, I didn't get to bring up, because I wanted to say when he was talking about Jet and Tony Meehan and Brian Bennett, because one thing I have done is I've been listening to some sort of some Shadows deep cuts, you know, like Nivram, which of course is Marvin backwards, and Shadoogie stuff. And there's some amazing playing from the rhythm section. Gotta say, there's some like really phenomenal bass playing, like what that you just weren't hearing at that time.
Yeah. Oh, really? And Brian is a great drummer. Still playing.
Oh, again, but real inside out jazzy stuff.
Yes. Yes.
So, yeah.
Thank you to our producer today, Ian, for Gimme Sugar. Thank you to you for your eyeshadow.
Imagine that for my eye.
I think it's healing. As that was such a long interview with Bruce, it's almost got better.
Brilliant. And can I just say, Gary, congratulations on your BMI Icon Award.
Yes, broadcasting.
Gary has got a BMI Icon Award. I'm not. No, I don't know either.
I don't know why. Yeah.
No, I don't know what it is. I don't know. These are but it's fantastic.
Part of the business.
Very, very well.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So until next week. Good night from me.
And good night from them.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.